Hello, and welcome to another edition of On the Road Again, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your volunteer reader. Our trip today includes some diverse destinations. We'll start out in Costa Rica, then we'll travel to Victoria, Canada, little time in Las Vegas looking for some bargains, then some time in Zanzibar, and looking at something that has always unpuzzled me, and that is whether to pack or unpack during a vacation. So we'll start out with a New York Times article dated January 28, 2020. It's by Brian Miller, and the title is Savoring Costa Rica, Sip by Sip. Coffee, says Buzzy O'Keefe, the owner of the renowned River Cafe in Brooklyn, is the last thing a restaurant diner tastes, so it better be good. For Mr. O'Keefe, it seems, it's never good enough. Every couple of weeks, he assembles his chef and several staff members for a blind tasting of brews from around the world. Those that pass muster, typically under 20%, might find their way into the restaurant's ever-changing house blend, which typically contains beans from Colombia, Brazil, Sumatra, and Costa Rica. I've been searching for the perfect coffee since my 30s, said Mr. O'Keefe, now in his discriminating 70s. I have found that even the perfect blend will vary from time to time, depending on the year's crop. Something like wine, but not quite as fickle. Last year, when I learned he was planning a trip to coffee plantations in Costa Rica, I asked if I could tag along, a caffeinated cohort, one might say. On a balmy Sunday evening, we arrived in San Jose, the country's sprawling capital. We drove 20 miles to the town of Belen and the Costa Rica Marriott Hotel Hacienda Belen, a delightful Spanish colonial hotel with 299 rooms. On our first morning, we enjoyed a typical Costa Rican breakfast. It commenced with spectacular fruits and the country's omnipresent national dish called Gallo Pinto, which is spotted rooster. It's a simple but tasty combination of black beans, rice, onions, and cilantro. Our Gallo Pinto was served with the customary scrambled eggs, tortillas, and natilla, which is like sour cream, but not as thick. And on the table was a small bottle of the popular condiment called Lozano, which is like a sweet, savory steak sauce. The Central Valley affords visitors much more than coffee. Within a 2 to 3 hour drive, you'll find river rafting, hiking, waterfalls, rainforest expeditions, thermal springs, and bird watching. For the intrepid sightseer, a 2.5 hour drive takes you to the popular Peos Volcano, which is still active, where you can ascend nearly 9,000 feet by car and gaze down into a gurgling, steaming, sulfurous, molten crater. Mr. O'Keefe, tall, dapper, and scholarly looking, was interested in comparing freshly roasted Arabica coffee with what he purchases once the beans are exported to New York. Arabica beans are the highest quality. Robusta beans are generally for the mass market. They should be very similar if delivered promptly and shielded from air and sunlight. Our first destination was a coffee company outside of San Jose called Cafe Brit. It was founded in 1985 by Steve Aronson, an American now living in Costa Rica and a world authority on coffee, whose career dates to the early 1970s as an apprentice taster in Manhattan's former coffee district near the South Street Seaport. At that time, all of the good Costa Rican coffee was exported, and the inferior stuff stayed here, Mr. Aronson explained. He wanted to change that. He launched the first gourmet coffee growing and roasting company in the country and began domestic distribution, while at the same time building his export trade. Today, Brit Coffee is sold throughout much of Central and South America. The company conducts hour-long tours of its half-acre educational plantation, followed by a discussion and a short film. Guests are taken through the steps of coffee bean processing, from planting seedlings to harvesting, which are called coffee cherries, large red pods that hold 2 coffee beans each. Newly planted coffee bushes require 3 to 4 years to produce cherries. Once removed, the beans are dried, husked in a special machine, grated, and packed for transport. Some operations, like Brit, roast their beans in-house before shipping. At the end of our tour came a, quote, cupping, the professional term for coffee assessments. The cupping is not part of the basic tour. There's a $20 supplement per person. Okay, when we begin, will the coffee still be hot? Mr. O'Keefe inquired, sitting at a round table holding about 20 half-filled ceramic cups. Parentheses, he's a stickler for the proper coffee temperature at his restaurant. As with wine, the temperature at which coffee is served at professional tastings alters its characteristics. Hot coffee releases more aromatics. The coffee cups on the table contain brews from Arabica beans cultivated at different altitudes. Among them, Tarazu, which thrives in the high mountains southwest of San Jose, which is typically characterized as medium-bodied and high in acid, with hints of chocolate. Tres Rios, which is east of the capital, also with ample acid and a full, smooth body. Central Valley, the high-altitude region west of the capital, and known for smooth and full-bodied brews. And Orosi, to the southeast, said to be almost floral, although that eluded us amateurs. Mr. Aronson called out instructions, quote, stir the coffee, then place your nose so it's almost touching it. Sniff, then lift the cup over your lip and slurp. Expectoration is optional. Mr. O'Keefe tasted each brew methodically, returning to several for another slurp. He said that, for the most part, the differences were more subtle than he had expected. Being down here, I thought I'd be tasting peaches or something, he laughed. The Brit tour, about an hour, concludes with a Costa Rican buffet lunch. The following morning, we drove 5,000 feet above the lushly carpeted valley on the slopes of the irascible Peos volcano to the 2-year-old Starbucks Global Agronomy Complex and Visitors Center called Hacienda Alsacia. I would go for the view alone. Situated on a 600-acre working plantation, it is where the company conducts farming research and development, creates programs to help small-scale coffee farmers around the world boost their income, and educates the public about what Starbucks calls sustainable coffee. The hour-and-a-half tour is similar to that at Brit, but a little longer and more hands-on. It starts with demonstrations on how seedlings are planted and allowed to mature, and on how to dry beans by raking them over hot cement. At one point, the tour guide asked for a volunteer to help dry the beans under a wilting sun. There were no takers. He drafted Mr. O'Keefe, who stepped forward wearing the bemused expression of someone called onto the stage by a magician. 4 round trips with the rake was enough. A cupping followed, and Mr. O'Keefe noted that, not surprisingly, the darker the roast, the more intensely acidic and flavorful the coffee. Think of Starbucks' sharp and heavily roasted, some say over-roasted, product. Winding down the mountain, we happened upon La Casana de Dona Julia, two large barn-like structures with a sign reading, "Authentic Costa Rican Cuisine," in Spanish. We sat at a long picnic table and sipped chilled Imperial, a Costa Rican beer. Actually, by the time it arrived, it was only half chilled. A word about dining in Costa Rica restaurants. Service is slow, really slow. Take a walk between courses, slow. The menu carried all of the country's greatest hits, starting with a platter of gallo pinto, along with fried chorizo, a dense, pleasantly salty sausage, tortillas, another smoked sausage, refried beans, fried yucca, fried bananas, salad, and delicious chicken, with a sprinkling of Lozano sauce. Another Costa Rican staple is called torta de queso, which is kind of a thick, round tort made of melted fresh cheese and ground corn. Every day at 4 p.m., most Costa Ricans downshift the wheels of commerce to relax with a wedge of torta de queso and coffee. I was eager to sample the national dessert, tres leches, which is a sponge cake drizzled with three sweetened milks, evaporated, condensed, and fresh. You'll find it everywhere. If you're looking for a little opulence with your Arabica, it can be found half an hour from the airport at Finca Rosa Blanca Coffee Plantation Resort. It is snuggled amid 30 undulating acres of coffee. Everything is assiduously eco-friendly and sustainable, with 13 tropically themed rooms and two suites. Doubles around $350 with tax. The daily 2.5-hour coffee program, which is open to non-guests with reservations at $40 a person, is as much about rainforest ecology and preservation as what you sip at breakfast. Those of an Avarian bent can roam the heavily shaded 30-acre property to seek out some of the nearly 250 species of tropical birds. "We're all about being green and sustainable," said the farm supervisor and head roaster, Carlos Sanchez. "Even the hotel, we build it with recyclable materials." Our final stop was in the town of Naranjo, another short hop from the city, at the Espiritu Santo coffee tour. The coffee itinerary, by now I could moonlight as a tour guide, in a 600-acre plantation, is unveiled in 7 stages, from planting to merchandising. It can be a long lesson, but the engaging guides sense when to pick up the pace, and not least, they are great with children. That night, over dinner at Bacchus Restaurante in San Jose, Mr. O'Keefe reflected upon our 4-day coffee trek. "It was interesting to see firsthand how sensitive coffee is to the elements and to the politics of where it is grown," he observed. "Costa Rica has such an advantage being located here in this pretty much protected valley and in a peaceful, safe country." Hurtling through so many cups of coffee in 4 days was educational, he noted, as coffee, like wine, is a moving target, and the tasting never stops. This reminded Mr. O'Keefe of a little story he sometimes pulls out of his wallet when in the presence of wine connoisseurs about a television skit about wine tasting. Quote, "One actor said, 'I taste raspberries,' and another said, 'I taste pears, peaches, cherries,' and so forth," he said. When it came to the final actor, he said, "I taste crushed grapes. It's like that with coffee tours." And the title of this article has been Savoring Costa Rica, Sip by Sip. The next article takes us to Canada. Coming from the New York Times, dated February the 2nd, 2020, its title is, "Like its two royal guests, Canada's Most English City Reinvents Itself. It's by Dan Belefsky. If Prince Harry ever gets lonesome for royal life while in Canada, he can always visit his great-great-great-great-grandmother, perched at a dining room table over a glass of sherry, her hair lovingly shampooed and fluffed by one of her most devoted subjects. Unlike last week, Ken Lane, who once ran the Royal London Wax Museum in Victoria, British Columbia, kept Queen Victoria's wax head in a box in his basement, stored with the heads of Elvis, Grumpy Smurf, and other items from the museum, which shut down in 2020. But after the recent arrival of Prince Harry and his wife Meghan in Victoria, Mr. Lane decided to move the figure of Queen Victoria upstairs. He spent 3 days getting her ready for display, styling her real human hair imported from Italy. Wearing a crown, she now presides at his dining room table, as if in mid-conversation, with the figures of Queen Elizabeth II, Diana, Princess of Wales, and Winston Churchill. Union Jack napkins are at the ready, and multicolor Skittles are available for snacking. Mr. Lane hopes that Harry and Meghan's decision to retreat from their royal duties and move to Canada will nourish a renewed fascination with the British royals, and that his collection of 350 wax figures will then find a new home. Meghan and Harry are popular royals, and I feel sorry for what they've been through, said Mr. Lane, past chairman of the Victoria branch of the Monarchist League of Canada, which works to support Canada's constitutional monarchy. Harry's grandmother, Queen Elizabeth II, is the country's head of state. Victoria, on the southern tip of Vancouver Island, has long marketed itself as Canada's most English city. It is peppered with Tudor Revival architecture, pubs with names like The Churchill, and specialty shops selling marmalade jam. Until 1950, its police officers wore bobby-style helmets. Some residents, like Mr. Lane, have clung proudly to this image of Victoria. The city was established as a British trading post in 1843, before it became the seat of British Columbia's government and a popular destination for retirees and honeymooners. But increasingly shaped by a wave of new immigrants, a growing high-tech sector, and a mayor who refused to pledge the traditional oath of allegiance to the Queen, the picturesque city no longer aspires to be a, quote, little piece of old England. In many ways, said John Adams, 70, a local historian and city guide, the makeover of Victoria is not unlike the rebranding its newest and most famous residents are attempting. Harry and Meghan are a contemporary couple trying to break with tradition, and that is perhaps why they resonate so much here in Victoria, Mr. Adams said. Like them, this city is trying to bring an old past into the future. Harry and Meghan, also known as the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, are reportedly ensconced in an $18 million Canadian dollars, or nearly $14 million, French-inspired 8-bedroom beachfront estate on Vancouver Island, where they spent their Christmas vacation. Their presence has been greeted with a mixture of enthusiasm, curiosity, and studied indifference. But such is the overall interest generated by the royal couple's decision to move to Canada's westernmost province that the CBC, the Canadian broadcaster, issued an etiquette guide for would-be royal spotters that reads like a how-to from the Parks Authority for engaging with wildlife. Never touch a royal, the guide sternly warns, citing a royal expert. If presented to the couple, bow, or curtsy. Treat them like cats, it adds. Let them come to you. Lawyers representing the couple have threatened legal action against the British media after reporters hiding in bushes took photos of a beaming duchess walking with her son Archie in a public park near their rented home. Local residents, though, appear determined to leave them alone. A water taxi captain was feted as a local hero for refusing to bring a Japanese television crew to visit the property. On a recent day outside the estate, at the end of the long, narrow road leading to the property, two security men with British accents came outside and barked at curious journalists to stay away. Not everyone is thrilled by the Duke and Duchess's arrival, and even Mr. Lane is irked by their royal mutiny. "We are not amused," he said, using a quote attributed to Queen Victoria, to express his disappointment with the couple's decision to step back from the crown, which sent shudders through his tight-knit monarchist fraternity. Opinion on the royal couple was divided on a recent day during high tea, a popular ritual at the imposing and luxurious Empress Hotel, which was opened in 1908 and boasts vaulted ceilings and Bengal tiger head furnishings that hark back to the British Raj. Sitting among a large group of female friends, wearing fascinators befitting a royal wedding, as they sipped tea and devoured tiny egg and cucumber sandwiches, Christina Yee, a human resources manager, said she was, quote, drawn to the mystery of what it's like to be a princess or prince. But Rebecca Bertrand, who works in sales and whose mother is British, lamented that the royal couple's presence could raise local property prices. "No one wants paparazzi here," she added. Pritam Sunger, the high tea hostess, offered a practical view. "I love that they are here," she said. "It's good for tourism and the economy." Jordana Burns, a Vancouver native who also works in sales, had this to say, quote, "I could really care less." One person who is not obsessing about the royals is Victoria's mayor, Lisa Helps, a left-leaning historian who is passionate about pushing for affordable housing, raising chickens, and fighting inequality. The mayor, who was first elected as an independent in 2014, has drawn opprobrium from royalists like Mr. Lane because she refused to swear an oath to the Queen. Mr. Lane called that childish and churlish. In Canada, representatives at the provincial and federal level pledge allegiance to the Queen, but mayors in British Columbia aren't required to do so. In not swearing the oath, Ms. Helps said she had been protesting the subjugation of Indigenous people by the city's former British colonial masters. "I have deep respect for the British bones of this city," she said, over breakfast at a hip downtown cafe, adding that she would be delighted to welcome Prince Harry and Meghan to City Hall. "But to me, such an oath is an anachronism." The city, she stressed, was no longer a throwback to the British Empire, nor the place some British Columbians have mocked as home of, quote, the newlywed and the nearly dead. Instead, she said, 21st century Victoria was a place of Indigenous cultural affirmation. Green-friendly bike lanes, artificial intelligence companies, and immigration from countries with few ties to the crown, like China or Brazil. In Mr. Lane's living room, though, "God Save the Queen" was blaring. His House of Windsor-themed room is decorated with commemorative tea towels of Harry and Meghan's 2018 wedding and cushions festooned with Corgis, Queen Elizabeth II's favorite dogs. He lamented that Victoria had been hijacked by political correctedness, but he was still hopeful that his beloved Queen Victoria would find a new Canadian home, even if it was not in the city that bears her name. In any case, he added, in his collection, there was no wax figures of Prince Harry and the Duchess. Quote, "He's a spare, not the heir," he explained. The title of this article has been, "Like its two royal guests, Canada's most English city reinvents itself." I'd like to take a short break to remind you you are listening to On the Road Again, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's my pleasure to be your volunteer reader. Our next article is entitled A Traveler's Guide to the Best Bets in Las Vegas. It's from the Frugal Traveler section of the New York Times travel section, dated January 31st, 2020, and it's by Elaine Glusak. "I have spent a lot of money in Las Vegas, and I don't gamble much. I paid $250 for a Cirque du Soleil ticket, taken a gondola down the faux canals of Venice for $60, and on occasion vastly exceeded my wine budget. Las Vegas thrives on convincing visitors to splurge, which I considered when Lady Gaga opened her concert residency at the Park Theater. Recently, tickets for the back row center balcony were selling for $466. Fans in the front row were paying $2,500 a seat. Value, of course, is subjective, but price creep on the Strip, as the casino line stretch of Las Vegas Boulevard is known, is objective, as resort fees at several high-end casinos rose $6 to $45 a night this year. Rooms, food, drink, and entertainment are increasingly important moneymakers for casinos, where gambling revenue has fallen from nearly 62% in 1984 to a little under 43% in 2018, according to the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. On a quest to find value, I spent 3 days riding buses, hunting for cheap and tasty eats, and sampling bargain entertainment. Here's what I found. There is one certain money saver in Vegas, the bus. The city of endless traffic lights and taxi fleets is a tangle to transit. Even ride shares are expensive. I took an Uber less than 1 mile one evening and it cost $8. But the bus system is affordable and reasonably efficient, especially if you stick to the Strip. A double-decker bus called the Deuce runs 24 hours between downtown and Mandalay Bay Resort. A 2-hour pass costs $6, an all-day pass costs $8. I bought a $20 3-day pass and got access to the entire transit system, including a clean, spacious, and uncrowded bus from the airport to the Strip, which paid off on that first ride. Everything about taking the bus, of course, takes a little longer. I waited for 10 minutes at the airport terminal, rather than just hopping in a cab. After a few stops, I connected to a Strip-bound bus at the South Strip Transfer Terminal, a mass transit hub, which was easy to navigate. The payoff to this relatively slow form of travel was a scenic ride past the Welcome to Las Vegas sign and other landmarks. Other than the Deuce, which can be dominated by tourists, most of the buses I rode were used by local workers and students, with a rare sprinkling of visitors. On the suggestion of a friend, I bussed from the airport directly to Tacos El Gordo, a 60-minute trip. I missed the 108 bus, which gets there in about half the time. With roots in Tijuana, Mexico, the cheerfully crowded taco stand in a nondescript strip mall between downtown and the Strip features a row of meat carvers behind the counter, ready to shave spit-marinating pork into pliant corn tortillas for $2.60. Two tacos topped with chopped onions and cilantro made a bargain meal. I was lucky to get a table. It's not that you can't eat cheaply on the Strip. Donald Cortusi, the owner of Lip-Smacking Foodie Tours, introduced me to several specials, including the $29 three-course lunch, which includes creamy Greek spreads, such as tzatziki and grilled fish, at Estiatoro Milos, and $5 happy hour appetizers at Mr. Chow. At Eataly, a bustling new food hall that anchors the Park MGM Hotel in a space that could double as a train station, focaccia slices sold from $2.90. But by wandering farther afield, I found intriguing and affordable food. Downtown, I wandered from the dimly lit downtown cocktail room, lively with locals during happy hour, when my $12 Paloma was $6, that's Monday through Saturday, 4 to 7 p.m., to the new Robata Bar, Hatsumi at Ferguson's downtown, a former motel now housing restaurants, shops, and co-working spaces. Decorated in cartoon monsters, Hatsumi served skewered meats, $2 to $6 each, to the mostly under 40 urbanites who are now repopulating downtown Las Vegas. A friend who lives in another gentrifying neighborhood, the Arts District, guided me to Abel Baker Brewing Company, an industrial spot with the brew kettles in the back, named for the first two atomic bombs, Abel and Baker, detonated at the Nevada test site north of town in 1951. Here we had juicy IPAs. Most pints were $5 to $8, and generous pork sandwiches for $9. On the cusp of the Arts District, I paid $6.50 for a chicken-stuffed arapa, or corn cake folded taco style, at the Venezuelan Viva Las Arepas, a low-key, quick-service spot where I watched Latin America telenovelas with the office lunch crowd. Through Eater, which has a thorough guide on cheap eating in town, I discovered Takapa, a tiny and friendly Japanese spot, where I sat at the bar and watched the cooks prepare their specially fried octopus fritters, four for $4.95, in Chinatown, a neighborhood filled with Pan-Asian dining deals that required two buses to reach, but worth every bite. Beware of resort fees. Cheap hotels aren't hard to come by in Las Vegas, though rates vary with business and event traffic. My spacious $40 room at the El Cortez Hotel and Casino downtown was $100 the previous week when several conventions were in town. Wherever you stay in Las Vegas, you're bound to have sticker shock because enticing offers, $19 a night, don't include resort fees, which run about $25 to $45 a night. The $25 fee at El Cortez brought my nightly rate to $65, still a good deal for an updated room, with lime green walls and Art Deco style black and white decor, in-room coffee, and a ground floor gym. For a real retro stay, downtown's 1906 vintage Golden Gate Hotel and Casino has 10 original rooms, small but updated for those who just need a bed, that often sell for $25, plus a $25 resort fee. When it comes to cultural attractions in Las Vegas, expect to pay. The Mob Museum charges $29.95 admission, but if you're interested in history, you'll get your money's worth learning about the role of Prohibition in establishing organized crime at the former post office and courtroom where hearings were held on the subject in 1950. Also uniquely Las Vegas, the Neon Museum preserves the city's cast-off signage. I paid $24 for the 25-minute night show Brilliant, which syncs light and sound to reanimate the otherwise dark signs. The separate tour of the regular collection, called the Boneyard, cost $30. During my stay, the lowest ticket available for, quote, Run, the new Cirque du Soleil show, was $79, or $105 with fees. Instead, I spent $37, or $52 with fees, to take in the Mack King Comedy Magic Show at Harrah's Las Vegas, a daytime-only delight starring the Kentucky-born star who manages to entertain all ages with surprising tricks, sly humor, and hilarious interactions with audience volunteers. Being the affordable show has been good for me, said Mr. King, who started out in 2000 with tickets at $10. Now it's like buying an airplane ticket with all the fees. In 3 days, I walked 22 miles and didn't really notice, given the entertaining hustlers en route. On my walks, I saw costumed showgirls posing for pictures, listened to a classical violinist, and passed up one gentleman who offered, according to his sign, quote, to do nothing weird for a dollar. When I needed a break, I went to the wildlife habitat at the Flamingo Hotel and Casino. At 2 p.m. daily, a keeper feeds two rescued California brown pelicans, Bugsy and Virginia, named for Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, who built the original Flamingo in 1946, and his girlfriend, Virginia Hill, and calls out to the other exotic waterfowl, including Chilean flamingos. The rare smoke-free haven provided benches, which are also rare, and complimentary Wi-Fi. Among free tours, I attended an open house at Ka, the high-tech Cirque show at the MGM Grand. It essentially functions as a 30-minute sales pitch for the show, but offers a fascinating look at the 80,000-pound rotating stage and other wizardry. Another morning, I signed up with the concierge at the Park MGM for a free art tour of the garden-themed resort and was introduced to contemporary works by Guy Yanai and David Hockney. Similarly, the nearby Aria Resort offers tours and a self-guided map to sculptures by Maya Lin and Henry Moore. Downtown's free attraction, the Viva Vision Light Show at the Fremont Street Experience, projected on a 1,500-foot overhead video screen, attracted more buskers. But the real payoff was at Golden Spike, a former casino billed as, quote, an adult playground, free admission. Instead of gambling, there's a bar, co-working spaces, and indoor games like cornhole and a vast outdoor yard where I caught a soulful set from Cimarar Denise, a local singer. On my return to the airport, I stopped at the nearby Pinball Hall of Fame, free admission, and spent $5, one quarter at a time, playing games that went back as far as 1964, the kind of slot machines that pay off in joy. The bottom line, the cost of my trip was about $350 for a 3-day stay in Las Vegas. And this article's title has been A Traveler's Guide to the Best Bet in Las Vegas. Our next journey takes us to Zanzibar, and the title is Zanzibar in the Rain. It's dated January 22nd, 2020. It's by Sarah Kahn. If my circumstances had not been so dire, or rather if my circumstances had been drier, I might have found myself at the Zanzibar Curio Shop. At first glance, the store did little to distinguish itself from other trinket purveyors besieging the tangled lanes of Stone Town, the historic quarter on the coast of Ugaja, Zanzibar's main island. Hakuna Matata t-shirts obscured the facade and tourist-browsed souvenirs. In any city, I'd breeze past, but sodden from the fury of a downpour, feigning interest in refrigerator magnets seemed a small price to pay for shelter. If you want to see the real history of Zanzibar, you have to come upstairs, says Murtaza Akbiarli, who, with his brother, runs the store their father opened in 1968. And so I followed him through a portal to Zanzibar of yore. Hand-carved wood and brass trunks teetered against one wall. Vintage cigarette ads from India and political posters from Tanzania formed a retro pastiche on another. The ceiling was an inverted necropolis of time-worn lanterns and teapots suspended from the rafters. Cameras and African tribal busts were jumbled in some nooks. Others were orderly archives of domestic ephemera. A wall of grandfather clocks, a cluster of rusting keys, likely belonging to earlier iterations of the brass-studded doors I'd been compulsively Instagramming all over Stone Town. I flipped through bundles of black-and-white Indian matrimonial headshots, the subject's bouffants, curlicues of eyeliner, and flared pants suggesting a 1960s provenance. In one room, I paused before a glass cabinet of daggers, glinting with bejeweled and mother-of-pearl hilts. You have to be careful when writing about a place like Zanzibar to not reduce it to a series of prosaic meditations on brilliantly sunny skies, blindingly white beaches, and beguilingly azure waters. Even the British explorer Sir Richard Francis Burton wasn't immune. Quote, "Truly prepossessing was our first view of the then mysterious island of Zanzibar," he wrote in, quote, "Zanzibar City, Island and Coast." This was written in 1872. Quote, "The sea of purest sapphire, under a blaze of sunshine which touched every object with a dull burnish of gold," end quote. To prevent such exaltations from finding their way into my own notebook, Zanzibar made sure I encountered nothing of the sort. I'd landed on the first day of a delayed rainy season. While I'd been ready for showers, nothing, short of packing an ark, could have prepared me for the apocalyptic tempest that descended with my flight. Swimming in sapphire seas might have been out of the question, but I hadn't considered swimming down streets that had been transformed into gushing canals. These were not silvery, romantic mists slinking through lattice rooftops. This was a miasma of damp and despair. Undeterred, I brandished my umbrella like a shield and waded through the waterlogged streets of Stone Town. While I certainly wouldn't have minded them, beaches and sunshine weren't what had lured me anyhow. As someone who lived in the Middle East, India, and Africa, I've long been curious about the confluence of the three cultures on an archipelago that could, on a map, be mistaken for ink splotches in the Indian Ocean, just off the coast of Tanzania. The Swahili language spoken here is a composite of Bantu and Arabic, with tributes to Persian, Portuguese, English, and Hindi. The architectural dialect is also complex, a dulcet dialogue between African, Arab, Indian, and European influences. The briny air gnawing patterns into walls, the serpentine lanes shaded by filigreed balconies and the ornately carved teak doors all lend Stonetown a dreamlike beauty that even sheets of rain can't obscure. The culturally layered cuisine I would sample, and the mishmash of trinkets I browsed at Zanzibar Curio Shop, scavenged from estate sales, told me more about Zanzibar than a sun-drenched beach ever could. Zanzibar is not just one thing, Arab, Indian, Persian, or Bantu. It's what they call Swahili, the fashion designer Farouk Abdallah said. With his dark glasses, embroidered kaffia hat, and playful smirk tugging at his lips as he doles out sharp one-liners, Mr. Abdallah is hard to miss. But if you want to be certain to catch him, your best bet is dropping by the Emerson Haruzmi Hotel, an elegant 19th-century mansion once owned by a wealthy advisor to a sultan. Mr. Abdallah designed the hotel's jewel box interiors and holds court most mornings on a divan in his lobby. It's very difficult for people to place Zanzibar. Is it the Orient? Is it African? What is it? He paused. I think that's what makes it interesting. You can trace the cultures that mingled in Zanzibar through Mr. Abdallah's lineage. He is a native Zanzibari of Comoran, Indian and Arab descent, who spent much of his life in England before returning to Stonetown 16 years ago. Zanzibar is the most peaceful place in the world, he declared. We are all one. I can't go against Arabs because I have a little blood of that. I can't go against Indians because there's a little blood of that. You can't pick a fight with someone because of their ethnicity or because of their faith. It's a noble sentiment, but one that downplays Zanzibar's complex and often tragic history. Straddling strategic coordinates for ancient trade routes, Zanzibar was, for centuries, where far-flung corners of the world converged. The region was settled by Bantus from mainland Africa, then Persians, Portuguese, and Arabs, each wave leaving indelible influences on the language, dress, food, and religion. Today, Zanzibar's population is almost entirely Muslim. For two centuries, it was part of the Sultanate of Oman. For a brief period in the 1880s, the Omani capital was moved from Muscat to Stonetown. The archipelago became immensely wealthy from the brutal slave trade to both Europe and Asia, and was also a hub for ivory and spices. Europe's scramble for Africa saw Zanzibar become a British protectorate in 1890. Then finally, a violent 1964 revolution led to Zanzibar's union with Tanganyika, now known as Tanzania. Spices remain one of Zanzibar's calling cards, though things have changed quite a bit over the centuries. Back in the day, pepper had as much value as cocaine today, said Raphael Fleury, a Swiss lawyer who is now the director of the spice cooperative 1001 Organic in Stonetown. These days, Zanzibar's purported spice farms tend to mainly be for show, staging tours and performances geared toward visitors. In fact, many of the spices on sale in Zanzibar's markets are imported. Seeking a less commercial outing, I join Mr. Fleury and Ethan Frisch, a New York-based entrepreneur whose company Burlap and Barrel imports spices directly from farmers around the world. Mr. Frisch was in Zanzibar on a sourcing trip, and on a rare morning when the sun pried its way out of the clouds and held the raindrops at bay, I tagged along as they met with farmers growing nutmeg, cinnamon, and black pepper. Spices have been ignored in the global food revolution, Mr. Frisch said. There are heirloom tomatoes, single-origin coffee. I'm trying to find heirloom spices. While burlap and barrel procures everything from Icelandic kelp flakes to blue turmeric from Vietnam, Zanzibar had been Mr. Frisch's first scouting trip in 2016. Quote, "It's a place ignored by the global commodity trade, but with a significant history of spice trade," end quote. But what really drove me to Stonetown, and what kept beckoning me out into the spongy air and sleepy off-season streets, was the food. The island's long relationship with spices and the cultures that converged in pursuit of them have concocted a singular and delicious culinary tableau. In Zanzibar, fusion is a creed, not a craze. A mixture of culture rather than food is how Mr. Abdella described Oroho to me. The stew, popularly known as Zanzibar mix, is hearty, rainy day food, best slurped, not eaten. Quote, "It's all the cultures of Zanzibar in a little bowl." When I tried it for myself, it was as though my taste buds were circumnavigating the world. A few chunks of mishkaki, or East African grilled meat, sliced off a skewer, were draped with Indian-inspired fried bahias, local cassava strips, and chunks of potatoes, originally introduced to the region from the Americas by Europeans. Then layered with general dollops of coconut chutney and fiery chili sauce, and doused in a sour mango broth. The dumplings yielded deferentially to my fork. The soup was bright and citrusy, and each sloppy spoonful came laden with visions of the sunny afternoons and the balmy weather that weren't written in my destiny. On most days, the storms were relentless, so it was a relief to escape the worst of the downpours with the promise of a meal. During one cloudburst, I ducked into Ma Sha Allah, a no-frills cafeteria-style restaurant, to bide my time over a plate of beef masala. During another, I watched sheets of rain lash the beach from the cosseting confines of the Serena Hotel, where I tucked into Kuku Paka, a flavorful chicken coconut stew, popular along the Swahili coast in Kenya and Tanzania. From a woman hunched in a sheltered nook off the side of the road, I picked up a pillowy disc of makate wa ufuta, which is sesame bread baked over coals, and ripped off chewy, perfectly charred chunks to nibble on a baraza, a shaded bench that's a fixture outside traditional Swahili houses. One sultry evening, I climbed a series of dizzying staircases of Estuarian proportions to the rooftop of the Emerson Spice Hotel, where course after course of traditional Zanzibari dishes with contemporary twists, such as tuna timbale, roast shili shili or breadfruit, chaza, oyster wrapped in spinach leaves, and coconut-crusted kingfish, were served with a soothing staccato of rainfall against the roof and the call to prayer, echoing from dozens of surrounding mosques. And yet the dish that had inspired my Epicurean exploits was in danger of eluding me. The curiously named Zanzibar pizza, a snack I'd never tasted and yet had somehow developed an unlikely sort of nostalgia for. Now I just needed a long enough respite from the elements to find it. You can smell Stonetown's main culinary destination before you see it, the nightly open-air food market at the sea-facing Foro Dahani Gardens. It's usually a festive affair, but on my first visit, the weather put a literal damper on the market and washed the vendors out. I turned to satisfy my craving on another drizzly evening, bypassing stalls, cranking out sugar canes, juice, and Arojo to make a beeline for a row of pizza hawkers with names like Mr. Delicious and Mr. Big Banana before the rains triumphed again. I watched entranced as a jovial chef, I'd gone with Mr. Nutella, rolled out a mound of greasy dough, slick with oil and likely more than a few dashes of perspiration and rainwater. Against that gleaming canvas, he scattered minced beef, sprinkled a chiffonade of onions, tomatoes, and green peppers, dressed it all with salt, mayonnaise, cheese, and a spicy condiment, then cracked an egg on top of it before slapping it on a griddle until it attained that optimal level of chewy, crispy communion. I'd barely finished my last bite when I felt the unmistakable splat, first on my shoulder, then on my cheek, and then on my head, then everywhere, all at once. The rains were back without warning, though at this point I knew better than to expect one. I followed other diners to congregate under a feeble tent until it passed, but what was the point? Instead, I splashed my way back out into the sticky night, soggy, but satisfied. And the name of this article has been Zanzibar in the Rain. And with that, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'm going to have to delay the Traveler's Conundrum Unpack or Not Unpack article. I'll start out with that next week. I appreciate you listening. This has been On the Road Again, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. My name is Chuck Berry. I've had the pleasure of being your volunteer reader for today. I hope you have a wonderful day, and thank you for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.